Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
I have the pleasure of introducing Todd Robertson, who is a dear friend of the Council. He's helped us really promote international affairs in Dallas, which I know a lot of you see that it's kind of lacking in our news, and Todd's been really great about pushing that. He's been a great supporter of the Council. He helped us launch our YP program past month. And Todd's really what I would consider the more romantic version of an international correspondent. Not romantic like that, Jim. But, you know, before the days of 24-hour media, before everybody was embedded with the troops and always had a camera crew with them, Todd's really kind of the old guard of the international correspondents. You'll see in his presentation his pictures literally with the people that he's reporting on with his camera always on hand. And just really covering the hottest news. He's been kidnapped twice. I always have to mention this. Shot at several times and subject to a mock execution. So he's really got real, true international correspondent experience, which he will share with us soon. Thanks.
Does this work?
Yes, yes. It works.
Ooh, okay.
Well, if it's any consolation, I get nervous too. So, well, let's see. Before I begin, I'm going to be embedded with troops at Fort Hood later today for 4 days. And I thought it might be an interesting experience for all of you, if you're so inclined, to see what just a fraction of the types of things that troops have to carry around with them, as well as correspondence these days. So I brought along a helmet and a flak vest and the plates that go inside of the flak vest. You're welcome to come up at any time and pick these up just so you can see the amount of weight that they have to carry around. Altogether, this is probably 30 pounds. And that, I once added it all up. If you add ammunition clips, a pistol, M5 weapon,
water.
If you add it all up, they carry around something between 55 and 75 pounds. That's if they don't have specialty equipment. It's an unbelievable amount of stuff, and they have to move very quickly with this stuff. Sometimes they have to run. So if you just want to get a sense of what that's like, come and pick this up. You'll be really amazed. Anyway. I was out jogging this morning, and I got about 50 yards beyond my house, and the neighbor's dog came up and tried to attack me. And he got within a foot of me, and I know how to handle this dog. It's a direct result of my experience as a foreign correspondent. I turned around and made myself much bigger than I really am, both politically and stature and everything else. And I growled at him, and I showed my teeth, and I said no, and he still continued to bare his teeth, but he backed off. I made him back off, and I stepped closer and closer to him, and I made him get off of the street. But he was close to attacking me. I ran, got back in, checked my email. I swear this is true. Everything I tell you is true today. I looked at my email. I have a friend who used to work at the Morning News. He took the buyout. He moved up to Anchorage, Alaska, and is working at the newspaper up there. And he sent me an email from a friend of his who was out jogging, got attacked by a moose. and the guy happened to have a heart monitor, which he ran with, and he said when he started out, that he connected it to his computer, and he started out, and it was at 130, something like that, and at a certain point, it jumped up to 175. So, all right, well, before I get into all of these slides, this is an email that I had a friend from Beirut from 1983-84. He used to be my boss there, and a lot of my friends who have books coming out all of a sudden kind of reappear in my life because they wanted to get a review of their book in the Dallas Morning News. So he wrote me, said, how have you been all these years and whatnot, but he's got a book coming out. So I kind of gave him a brief synopsis of where I've been in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Mexico, Colombia, Panama, etc., Washington Post, Dallas Morning News. And then I said, it's been quite an adventure. I've been shot at Afghanistan, sued for $1 billion, that was in Panama, arrested, that was in Turkey, shot at again, that was in Mexico, kidnapped in Beirut, captured in El Salvador, shot at again in Iraq, and treated badly Israel. I hate to be treated badly. Okay, so if you want to take this over, I don't know if, let's see if you just tap that, it'll advance. So, this is a story. Let's see. We're going to go into quick succession on this. I'm going to tell you, having been on the front lines, having been in the wars, I'm going to tell you a story of ambushes, sniping, chaos and confusion, backstabbing, a mad scramble for self-preservation. You thought I was going to talk about Iraq, but no, I'm going to talk about American journalism. Go ahead and advance it. Before we begin, this is the story of Todd Robertson. This is a photo that was taken of me in Baghdad probably a few weeks after the statue fell there. Go ahead. Just so you know where I've been. Technically my second job as a correspondent, I had a brief internship in Saudi Arabia in 1981 in Jeddah, and I was sports and economy editor of Arab News in Saudi Arabia. That, believe it or not, led to a job at the Washington Post, which then led to a job in Beirut as a military correspondent for a new English language newspaper there called the Daily Star. And this was back in the days when American journalists were able to go literally on the same day from one side of the Green Line to the other, because we had almost diplomatic status in Lebanon. All of the militias understood what the journalist was, what their job was, what their status was. Nobody messed with it. So on one day I decided to test it, and so I was on the Shiite side of the Green Line in the morning, and I went up through took this photo through a sniper hole, looking, eastward into the Christian half of Lebanon. And this is just obviously all the destruction of Beirut at the time. And then in the afternoon, I went to the other side, and I took a photo through another sniper hole from the other side. On the Beirut side, I got shot at. It was nasty. I was running in between two buildings, and the Christians shot at me as I was running past, and a guy who was with me stumbled, and we were really worried about it. But so I got into a sniper hole on the other side to look into the Shiite side. Just to give you an idea, these are the days when journalists really had stature in the world. We had respect, and that's because we were adamant about one particular principle, which was we didn't take sides. All that changed in Beirut, and what followed was what led to our own disaster, I think. Go ahead. So Lebanon led to the departure of this guy. This was a photo I took of him literally minutes before he boarded a ship in Tripoli, Lebanon, and left Lebanon for good. The PLO, regardless of how you feel about them, they were largely responsible for the civil war that happened in Lebanon, and once he was gone, it at least gave them a chance to work out their differences. It took them another probably 12 years to do it, but they managed to do it. Go ahead. After I left Yasser Arafat, I was working for Reuters News Agency at that point in Beirut, and one of our correspondents was kidnapped in the Bekaa Valley. And my boss asked me if I would go into the Bekaa Valley and look for him. And I said, sure. I took photos of our correspondent with Arabic messages explaining who he was, reminding people he was just a correspondent and whatnot. And on the way back, I met up with this guy, and I had been investigating him before. This is an American, and his name is Isa Abdullah Ali. And at the time, I thought it was another name, but I had done some research on him, and I was told in no uncertain terms by two different militias in Beirut, back off. Do not ask about this man. If you do, you're going to suffer some serious consequences. So I left it alone, but when Reuters asked me to go out and look for our missing correspondent, and on the way back I encountered this guy, I began to worry because I knew that this man had been involved, linked to a previous kidnapping of an American. In this case, he had rescued the guy, but it was under extremely suspicious circumstances. So I had reason to believe there was a problem here. Go ahead. When I asked a few follow-up questions about the guy, all of a sudden I got kidnapped. And these were all of the items that were in my wallet. And when I got kidnapped, I was chased down on my motorcycle in West Beirut after leaving the office one night at midnight. And the guy with the gun on me in the back seat asked me for identification. And so I handed him, I think, this ID first, and then I handed him this, which is of the Amal militia, which is the main militia, the main Shiite militia in West Beirut at the time, thinking, well, that's going to have some resonance with this guy. He laughed and he threw it on the floor. Then he threw all these other things on the floor. And before I knew it, the contents of my entire wallet was on the floor of this car. Go ahead to the next one. This is what the Amal militia ID said. That was my I had here. Go ahead. Anyway, I'll finish that story in a second. I got kidnapped. I was held very briefly. It was less than an hour. It was hair-raising. I'll explain a little bit more about what happened later. But Reuters got me out of Lebanon, and they made me a regional correspondent. I lived in Cyprus, and I covered mainly Syria and Iraq. And one of my first trips into Iraq, it was in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War, 1984-85. So Saddam Hussein was actually receiving aid from the Americans at the time, and he wanted to let American correspondents know that they were in fact winning the war, they were fighting, and he was very, very interested in impressing the American correspondents. So after they had a big human wave of offensive in southern Lebanon, you can see the marches in the background. These are tanks up here, Iranian tanks, that were knocked out, and some other fortifications. Anyway, they were overwhelmed. The Iraqis were overwhelmed on this particular offensive. And so the Iraqis went in, and they swept through the place, they got it under control again, and they left these bodies out for 3 days in the hot southern Iraq sun. I mean, at 90 degrees and above. And until they got everything all prepared. And then they brought the journalists down, so you can imagine what it smelled like when we got there. These are pretty bloated bodies. And then they took us on a little tour. There were thousands of these bodies, absolutely thousands. And as I went from body to body, I started to notice something really unusual. You'd have to look at it very closely, but you can see right here there's a little hole in the head. And there's a little hole in the head right there. They went around and they put a hole in they fired a bullet into the head of every single body there, but there's no blood coming out. It's because they gassed them. And it was painfully obvious to every single one of us who was there what had happened there. So it was just one of those experiences you kind of put in your mind and figure, well, this will come in handy later on. Go ahead. So we get back to Isa Abdullah Ali. I left Reuters after a few months living in El Salvador. They made me the El Salvador bureau chief, and I was captured while doing interviews in guerrilla-controlled territory in El Salvador. The army launched an invasion to capture me, as well as the photographer and a BBC correspondent I was with, and they held us for 10 hours. And then after we left, we were freed. The Salvadoran army had confiscated all of our notes, our film, and our tape recordings, went in and killed four people in the village that we had been staying in. There was a level of guilt and responsibility that I felt there that I just could not get over. Reuters refused to accept any responsibility for it, even after members of Congress and members of Parliament in London condemned the capture and the confiscation of the notes. Reuters refused to lift a finger. At the time, I got an offer for a fellowship at Georgetown University. I knew the Washington Post was more than happy to have me back on their staff, and so I quit Reuters and moved to Washington. So while I was working on my master's degree in Arab Studies at Georgetown University, I started filing Freedom of Information requests because I always had this nagging question in my mind, why was I kidnapped? What was behind all of that? And so I did a bunch of Freedom of Information requests on the guy by a different name, but it eventually led to this guy, Issa Abdullah Ali. And he turned out to be an American who was in fact living in Washington, D.C. at the time I was doing all my Freedom of Information requests. Go to the next one. This led to an article in the Washington Post, Sunday magazine, and this was a little sidebar that went with the main article. The main article was about him, his childhood, everything that led him to become a Muslim and then move over to Afghanistan, then Iran, then Lebanon, where he became an advisor to the Shiites. He was actually a liar. He told them that he was former Special Forces and he trained them, and they really believed in his training techniques. But anyway, because I asked all of the wrong questions, they kidnapped me. And so the key words, and they asked me to write up a kind of a personal story of what happened to me, and the key words in all of this is down on the bottom. It's a bit out of focus, but I didn't know how to say in Arabic, are you kidnapping me or just stealing my motorcycle? So I simply asked, motosik bye-bye? And the guy with the gun on me in the back, big beard, said, no, motosik no bye-bye, you bye-bye. And that's, I talk about heart monitors, they didn't have them back then, but I firmly believe mine was way over 175 at that point. It was, I could feel my heart beating. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I really did. It was really awful. So I did all of these I tracked down to Issa in Washington, D.C., and convinced him to sit down and do a series of interviews with me. I did a total of about 40 hours of interviews with him. And we actually established a good working relationship. All that time, he denied that he had anything to do with my kidnapping, until one day I gave him a long lecture about the importance of being honest, that in his religion as well as mine, that's an absolute key element of your basis of morality. And so after I turned off the recorder, he stood up and he said, I have something to tell you. I said, what? And we were in my living room in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting there alone with this guy. He's towering above me, and I'm sitting in the chair, and he says, I ordered your kidnapping. And all of a sudden, for the first time in years, all of a sudden my heart started pounding again, exactly as it did before, and I was panicking. I just didn't know what to do. So I was speechless, and I, well, I guess it's good to know that. And there was this long silence, and he goes, well, are you mad at me? I didn't know how to answer. Go ahead to the next one. Well, after that, really, literally, within a few weeks of that article being published, the Washington Post asked me to go to Baghdad, and I was the last Washington Post correspondent in Baghdad before the war began. Let's see, how do I tell this story? I had just finished my degree at Georgetown University. I was absolutely at the peak of my abilities to speak Arabic, and when they sent me over there, I actually did an interview in Arabic with the Speaker of the House in Iraq, and he was very favorably impressed with the fact that the Washington Post would have a correspondent who actually spoke Arabic, first time he'd ever seen anything like that. And I got a really good front page story out of it, and it made me start to think, you know, there's some disconnect there when correspondents come in with their translators and everything. Obviously, something gets lost that leads to misunderstandings. It leads to I don't know, just a difference in behavior among leaders, correspondents, and the message that they're trying to convey to the world. So I really, at that point, understood the value of what I had done by investing 3 years of my life in learning Arabic and getting my master's in Arab studies. So back at the Washington Post, Ben Bradley sat in on a meeting of all of the top editors, and all of a sudden he was noticing all of these front page bylines, and I had kind of snuck in through the back door of the Washington Post as an editor, first a part-time editor, then a full-time editor. And he had never met me. And Bradley used to insist on meeting everybody who was writing for the newspaper. He had to know who we were. And so he barged into this news meeting and said, you know, who the hell is Todd Robertson? And everybody laughed. And then the foreign editor said, well, you know, he studied at Georgetown. He speaks Arabic, speaks, reads, and writes Arabic. You know, he's got a master's degree in Arab studies. He's been a correspondent in Beirut and Iraq and Syria. So Bradley was impressed and everything. And then the ombudsman for the Washington Post happened to be sitting in on the meeting and wrote an entire column where he asked the question, who is Todd Robertson? And then he used it as an example to say, this is the quality of the people that we have at this newspaper that readers would never know about. And it's important occasionally to remind them we do have people who know what they're doing here. So I was still over in Baghdad at the time. We're getting within days of the start of the bombing. And I hadn't offered to leave, and they hadn't asked me to leave. And as we got closer and closer, I started colluding with the correspondents for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and we realized that our editors were all in touch with each other. And so we started playing this game where I would tell my editor, well, the New York Times correspondent is going to get to stay until the 12th. And so they would say, okay, well, then you stay till the 13th. And then they would tell their editors, okay, he's going to stay to the 13th, and then they get to stay to the 14th. We all got to stay until the 15th, which is the day the bombing was supposed to start. And then all of the editors realized what was going on. So they ordered us as a group to leave. And it sent a horrible message to the Iraqi government because they ordered us to leave because the White House had told them that we are going to bomb the hell out of Baghdad, and we cannot guarantee the safety of your correspondents. We cannot guarantee that they'll be able to communicate by satellite, phone, or any other method. Once the bombing begins, we're going to take out Iraqi communications. Everything that they will use will be taken down. So they were really trying to get us out of there. Now, maybe they were trying to get us out of there so that there wouldn't be any witnesses afterwards. I don't know. But the Iraqis knew the U.S. government was pressuring the newspapers to pull out their correspondents. When we pulled out, the message to the Iraqi government was the American correspondents do what the U.S. government tells them to do. It was a really, really bad move on their part. I objected strongly. I was very tired. I've been recently extremely sick and probably lost about 15 pounds in 3 days. But I wanted to stay. So all of the editors of the Washington Post gathered at a meeting, and I think it were 12 of the section editors, department editors, and Ben Bradley at the table, and they took a vote, and Bradley didn't vote. The vote was exactly split down the middle, 6-6, 6 wanting to pull me out, 6 wanting to keep me there. Ben Bradley cast the deciding vote to pull me out. Then he gave an interview to David Frost because these were his last days of the Washington Post, and you know he had quite a legacy there. So David Frost asked him, "Tell me about your decision to pull the Washington Post correspondent out of Baghdad before the war began." And Bradley goes, "Oh, it was his decision. And I had been warned ahead of time because of this letter right here to watch that show. So I was watching, I went, I didn't decide it." And the managing editor of the newspaper came over to sit with me while I was watching this. He goes, "Hold on, it gets worse." Frost then says, "Well, why would he decide to leave? Well, he's got a family. He's got a wife and 3 kids." I was single at the time. Had no wife, no kids. "He's got a family. He's got a wife and 3 kids. And you know, some people just can't take it." At that time, I had been through 5 different wars. I'd been kidnapped, shot at. You know the whole story. So I was pretty upset. And then David Frost said, "Well, what if it had been you? You know, what if you had been in that situation? Would you have left?" He goes, "I've been in that situation. Would have been a chance he would have gotten me out of here." So Ben Bradley then writes me a letter. I really misspoke myself on a David Frost interview running Friday night, and I want to apologize for any suggestion I might have left that I was critical of you. Frost got me to say that I would have stayed in Baghdad without getting me to say that we not only approved the decision to leave, but damn well encouraged it. "I'm truly sorry, you did a fine job for us, etc., etc." I was quite upset about it, but anyway, what can I say? It got me the bureau chief's job in Mexico City and let me continue being a foreign correspondent after that. So, long story. So, almost 4 years in Mexico City for the Washington Post. And then my wife decided she just wanted a change of pace. She actually wanted to move back to Texas, but to do that, I had to get on with the Texas newspaper. And so I applied to the Dallas Morning News. They didn't offer me a job in Texas. They offered me a job covering all of Latin America, which led to us moving to Bogota, Colombia. So I started covering Colombia. Again, you know, the Colombians understood the world by the old rules. Journalists were journalists. They weren't partisans. And so you could literally go from one side covering the right-wing paramilitary groups, then the next day go over and cover the FARC militia, the leftist guerrillas, and you could go out and traipse through the poppy fields. These are poppies. This is about a 70-year-old man with his 4-year-old son, grandson, I should say. And this is how they live. They grow this stuff because it helps them survive. It's not. I asked this guy, "Do you have any idea what happens with this stuff when the men come and get it?" He goes, "No." He honestly had no clue. And I said, "You really don't understand?" No. Tell me, what? And I said, "Well, you know, people, they make this into a chemical that people inject into their veins on the streets of the United States, and it makes them very sick, and sometimes they die from this." And he was shocked. His eyes lit up, and I said, "You know, if you know that this is what you're growing, what it causes, are you going to continue doing this?" And he had to think about it for a second. He wasn't really sure because it's his livelihood at stake here. Next one. Anyway, 2001 happened, 9/11 happened, and I wound up going to Afghanistan, covering the war there, the first war, and then the elections. These are months after the war finished, and they had organized elections. Next. Years passed, and they started working on a program to make the old warlords disarm. And so this man, I don't know how old he is, quite honest, I just like the photo. He brought in his one weapon, which is an AK-47 with a very, very shiny pan head. I doubt he ever used it once, but he brought that in to hand it in because they were going to offer him money if he handed in his weapons. Next slide. And then in the middle of all of this, I met up with this guy. His name is Jonathan Keith Adema, otherwise known as Jack. He tries in every way possible to make himself look like a U.S. Special Forces member. He's just a civilian, and he went over to Iraq, to Afghanistan, and took up the mantle of the former leader of the Northern Alliance, and claimed that he was fighting the Taliban and whatnot. Go ahead. He got into the business of the U.S. military, the U.S. government offered a $25 million reward for anyone who could come up with information leading to the capture of Osama bin Laden. And I had an email from him that I got through various means in which he stated very clearly that's what he was after. Now, he denies that, but a bunch of people in the Pentagon started sending me stuff like this photo right here, which you'll see, not for release, et cetera, et cetera. He sent these to me as emails, and I got a hold of them. And he was kidnapping Afghans off the street. And I, from the best of my ability to determine how he got his information, it was as simple as, he saw people wearing turbans with long black beards and thought, well, you know, this is a good guy. Let's grab him. And he did it. And he beat them. He put holes in their head and then sewed them up afterwards. This is literally a photo of him sewing up a guy's head without anesthesia afterwards. Go ahead. Stuffed him in the car. Go ahead. Anyway, before I get to this slide. Before he got into the kidnapping business in Afghanistan, Jack Adema and I were sitting at a party one night. It was my last night in Kabul before I was going to head back to Panama, where I was living at the time. And we got into an argument, a heated discussion about something. It had to do with my experience in El Salvador, being out with the FARC, and when I was FMLN, sorry, I'm mixing up my leftist militia. FMLN in El Salvador, and I was talking about the importance of, you know, having the freedom to move around and do interviews, and he said, if I ever find out that you've been out interviewing Taliban or Al-Qaeda, I'm going to come and kill you. And I thought at the time he was CIA, and so I said, look, you got to understand, we can go places you guys can't go. So you better understand, we have value to you. This is not something you should be threatening me about. And one exchange led to another, and we are literally the length of a coffee table apart from each other. And I was into my spiel, he was into his spiel, I interrupted him, he interrupted me back and forth, and before I know it, bang! He had pulled out a gun. I hadn't even looked. Pulled out a gun, a pistol, a 9mm pistol, fired it at me, and missed my left shoulder by that much. Deliberately. Without a doubt, deliberately. He told me later, if I had meant to kill you, I would have killed you. We would have dumped your body out on the street, and the world would have thought you were kidnapped and killed by Al-Qaeda. And anyway, the bullet went through the couch, went into the wall, and got stuck there. So... he thought that my investigations of him afterwards were all because I was bitter about being shot at, and it was just that I knew he was a fraud, and I was absolutely determined to prove that. Anyway, wound up going to Iraq after the war happened there. This is a photo out of the Taji garbage dump. This is an actual rocket that landed there, and I don't know if it's an American or an Iraqi rocket. I think it's an American rocket. Anyway, this kid was just playing around with it. It had not been disarmed. It didn't explode. And go to the next one. I went out at the time. These days, Taji is one of the most dangerous places in all of Iraq. I mean, absolutely, unbelievably dangerous. But I went out there to do a story about the kinds of garbage that the Americans were throwing away, and it was winding up in Iraqi garbage dumps, because it was some pretty significant stuff. It had surveys from troops about their fears, about all kinds of incidents that were happening at the time in Iraq. And I was just sifting through all this stuff and realized these people are actually getting their water. This is a stream. They're getting their water from this, and this is garbage that's in the water. Unbelievable. But people were living like this and surviving somehow. I don't know. Next slide. And then this is Sadr City, which used to be Saddam City back in the old days when I was covering Iraq. There were about 5,000 of these men all gathered, and this was at a time when nobody took Muqtada Sadr very seriously, and I was trying to write articles, lots of them, saying, this guy is putting together a militia, and he is getting ready to challenge the Americans. I wrote this in at least two different articles, I don't know, maybe three. But I probably one made it on the front page, I'm not sure. But these were 5,000 men all gathered there to basically pledge their allegiance to Muqtada Sadr. Next. This is just a fun photo. I went into an Iraqi mental institution, and there was a guy there, kind of an idiot savant, who was absolutely unbelievable at playing ping pong. Unbelievable. He beat me. I don't think I scored a single point against him. And so I was playing ping pong with him with all the other patients around me and everything. And then my wife called me, and so I picked up the cell phone, and I was talking and playing ping pong with him, and one of our photographers took that photo. Next. This is further disarmament in Afghanistan. This is T-54 tank, Soviet tank that they were handing in that day. Next. And I got inside of it. Very dusty. Let's see. You can't see. This is a live round. Yeah, they were all over the place. Next. And then this is Gaza. Just once again, obviously there's a theme here. I really, really like the idea of going from one side to the other and hearing both sides of the story. So just before the Israelis pulled out of Gaza, I went and spent a couple of days in an Israeli settlement in northern Gaza and just heard all of their stories, and they told me about this one incident where these three guys crossed over a fence and came in, and they killed this man's daughter, her fiancé, and someone else, I can't remember who. And everybody talked about it. It was really the major event in that settlement. And the next day, went around. It took me 10 hours to do it, but got into Gaza and then found the mother of the guy who organized that attack. And that's him right there. He's the one who organized the attack. She has another son who died in a similar suicide attack, and she has two or three other sons. And I asked her, you know, what would you think if you lose all of your sons? What would you think? And she said, I'd be honored. I'd be honored if I could be a suicide attacker. She was absolutely fanatic about this. She wound up running for the Palestinian parliament, and I think she won. I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that. But anyway, so that's just the general theme of this. I'm still really big on American reporters, on all reporters, getting out and telling both sides of the story, hearing both sides of the story, really understanding and empathizing with both, if not all, sides of the story, so that you can do a more complete job of covering it. What I'll get to in the questions later on is why we're facing such a crisis today in journalism and unable to do this anymore. I think that's it. Thank you. Questions? Everybody hear the question? Five or six of Muqtada Sadr's ministers pulled out of the Iraqi government, and what is going to be the impact of this on Iraq's ability to govern itself in the future. It's Well, you know, like everything in Iraq, it's hard to say what is going to happen. I would say that the impact is going to be significant. It's Muqtada Sadr's way of telling the Americans, I'm no longer cooperating with you or with the government that I feel that you installed in Iraq. So he's essentially saying, my militia is reactivated, we are pulling out of the government, and we're prepared to fight you. So the effect is they're gonna fight them in the streets of Iraq, and they're doing it at a time when all Iraqis know there's going to be a surge of troops, which isn't complete yet, and so the message is we're going to meet you head on.
Okay, tell us what you perceive to be the problems for journalists like Alan Johnston. Is it Alan Johnston, the BBC reporter?
The one in Gaza?
Yeah, who was kidnapped. And do we know anything more about him?
Yeah.
See, is this now a symptom of the change in journalists?
And it's unfortunate because, believe it or not, I mean, the BBC has a reputation, particularly in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, as, if anything, being pro-Palestinian. At least from the Israeli perspective, they have that reputation. So for the Palestinians to kidnap a BBC correspondent is a huge deal. What it means is the Palestinians, who were probably the very first group in the Middle East to kind of confer this diplomatic status on journalists and let us go from one side to the other, they really understood how it worked. They're basically, at least the more militant groups are saying, we don't accept this anymore. We think you're biased, and you're a part of the problem, not a part of the solution. Now,
why do they think? What's changed?
I want to say it goes back to 9/11, but I showed you a slide earlier, and I have to be quite honest with you. It goes back to Beirut. In Beirut, Ronald Reagan was, and the Israelis were very, very good at manipulating the media into thinking that the U.S. Participation in a multinational force in Lebanon was A, going to lead to peace in Lebanon, and B, it was going to be an impartial parting of the militias, get everybody to calm down, and then give peace a chance to do its work. What wound up happening was totally different. The Americans, without question, took sides. And they took sides with the Christian militia, the Christian side of Lebanon, which is the minority in Lebanon. And the American press was somewhat at a disadvantage at the time because the reporters there, for the main part, didn't speak Arabic. And they had to rely on people who did speak Arabic. And the vast majority of the translators in Lebanon at the time who spoke English were Christians. Now, whether it was fact or just the perception, I think the perception on the part of the Lebanese and the Palestinians was that this Christian influence was getting into American reporting on the war. And it resonated. It took a very long time. It took years before this kind of played itself out. But as one event after another built upon their experience in Lebanon, and then 9/11, where the American press coverage took a 90-degree turn and became pretty much unquestioning about American motives, about the information that was coming from the U.S. government, we didn't question it. And it was our job to question it, to really look into it and make sure that it was truthful and accurate. We didn't, in large part because the American public did not want us to do that. And I know that personally because I did look into some of these things. And occasionally I did question what was going on. I questioned in Afghanistan. I questioned the accuracy of what was being told to us by the U.S. military. And I was attacked in emails mercilessly I was accused of treason, of being un-American, of being pro-Al-Qaeda, pro-terrorist, you know, things that you just don't play with. This is dangerous, dangerous talk. So I didn't want to back off, and I'm sure these other reporters didn't want to back off, but you know, you get pressure from your editors, you get pressure from advertisers, you get pressure from the government, and so the effect is you try to even things out, what you think is kind of the even ground in all of this. I'm not proud of the way we perform. None of us are proud of it. The New York Times devoted 5 pages to explaining how unproud they are of the way they covered the build-up to Iraq. But that's the whole process. It started long ago, and it led up to this point where nobody seems to trust us anymore, and we're really caught in the middle.
So you're afraid about getting kidnapped if you went back here?
Yeah. You have to. You know, it's been a gradual process. Even in Iraq, I went... It was a bizarre set of circumstances, but a couple of times I went straight from Iraq to Jordan to Israel, from Afghanistan to Jordan to Israel, which is something you just don't do. I mean, I spent years thinking, you never do that. And I once really, really let a Dallas Morning News photographer have it, because she had come from Israel to Jordan to Afghanistan, and she dropped a shekel on the stairwell of our hotel. I picked it up, and I knew it came from her, and I marched into her room, and I said, look what I found on the stairwell. You do not do this. You do not do this. This leads to death, because people will think that you are an Israeli spy. So we're very sensitive to these things. But at the same time, we're also sensitive to the perception that the public has of our objectivity. And so it's a really careful balance that we have to play all the time. So it gradually built up to the point where we now have to have bodyguards wherever we go. Gaza, I don't know. I haven't been there in a couple of years now, but I suspect that now we really do have to have a bodyguard to get around there.
Given the perceptions that you've just alluded to, and changes in technology, can you jump forward in your own mind 10 or 15 years and speculate about where we will be getting our international news, and who will be providing that news, who will be writing those stories?
Great question. The way the industry is changing, it is changing so rapidly that the statistics that we know today may very well be out of date 6 months from now. We got a briefing from the managing editor of the Dallas Morning News just 2 weeks ago, and he was showing us statistics on circulation, the effect of the internet, the effect that all of this is having on advertising, and the picture is absolutely bleak. We are in a huge crisis phase right now. The publisher of the New York Times made a statement about a month ago saying he wasn't even sure if a print edition of the New York Times was going to be around 5 years from now. And the truth is, I don't even care. He told that to an Israeli newspaper. It's really bad. And it's there are multiple factors at play here. One is, newsprint costs have absolutely skyrocketed in the past 10 years. It's always been a problem, but when you combine newsprint costs with the costs of with the labor costs of putting together a daily newspaper, I mean, it's just a massive, heavily labor-intensive effort to put out a newspaper. If you, as a businessman, have an option, or businesswoman, I should say, in the case of some publishers, have the option of putting together something that isn't going to cost you that much money, has zero newsprint costs. You don't have to pay the guys to deliver it, any of that stuff. And you can reap all of the benefits of advertising and whatnot. Why not go for that? So I totally understand the publisher's viewpoint from a business standpoint. But the history of newspapers is totally different. Publishers have ignored all of those temptations up until now because they had what they thought was a higher calling, which was to inform the public about what's going on in the world. And they thought that trumps everything. But at some point in the 1990s, when the industry started to consolidate, two newspaper towns became one newspaper town, including Dallas. When that happened, newspapers, the industry boomed. We expanded like you would not believe. When the Dallas Times Herald closed, all of a sudden, the Dallas Morning News became a cash cow. When the Washington Star closed in Washington, the Washington Post became a cash cow. You could not believe the returns that they were getting in stock, 35% growth every year. And so the publishers and the corporate side of the news business started looking more and more at how the stock was performing. And that became the dominant factor influencing how we put out a newspaper. And that was our downfall, without question, because there was no way in the world we or any other industry is going to maintain a growth pattern of 20 to 30 to 35% a year. It's just not going to happen. Even Google isn't going to do that. So we have a crisis right now because they're trying to feed a beast that they cannot feed. They cannot continue to feed. Eventually, newspapers are going to have to get out of the stock market if they're going to hope to survive.
But how will that happen?
My idea, one option is, and I was kind of hoping it was going to happen at BLO, was that they were just going to buy a stock and go private again. The Chicago Tribune is going to do that. They're going to take them off of the stock market and go private. They were bought up by a private businessman who wants to just get them out of the stock business. The other option is for newspapers to establish an alliance with universities, which also don't sell stock, at least so far. And universities also have a vested interest in maintaining an absolutely strict dividing line between kind of the church and state of their financial interests versus the pursuit of...
Is there an example of that? Alliance between a university and a paper?
There isn't yet. There might be, but I haven't heard of it. I'm just offering it up as an idea. It's my personal. A few journalists have offered it up as an idea. I kind of came to that conclusion along with some other people. But I gave a speech at Texas Tech, and I really started to think about it. And I started to think, I graduated at Texas Tech, undergrad, and I was thinking, what was it? What was it about that made that so special? And the really neat thing about publishing a student newspaper was you were truly free of all of the influences of advertisers and anybody else who could try to shut you down and prevent you from publishing what you thought was the truth. Now, the danger of it was, you're a student. And I mean, you report some outrageous things when you're a student journalist. And you need a system of checks and balances. But one thing you do not need is the checks and balances imposed by stockholders.
Doc, what do you know about the geography of this GI city, Sauter City?
Yeah.
The report in the paper this morning says that it's being walled off.
Yeah.
Is it possible?
Well, it's not, I couldn't tell from the report what... where the wall was going to go. If it is Sauter City, that would make an awful lot of sense. Sauter City is surrounded by a big Shiite area, a huge Sunni area, and a big Christian area. And when the war had just finished, the statue had fallen, just masses and masses of people poured out of Sauter City into the Sunni areas and the Christian areas and just looted like crazy. And the Christians were the very first ones to set up barriers and blockade their neighborhood to try to protect themselves from these masses. they didn't judge them. They knew exactly why they were looting, because these people had were absolutely impoverished. They had no sewage system, no clean water system, no garbage pickup. Those photos I showed you of the garbage in the stream, that was at the Taji dump, but there were neighborhoods in Sadr City that were just like that. I mean, you could not breathe through your nose. It was so bad. And I used to sit and drink tea in some of these places and drink tea very cautiously, like, you know, you had your mouth closed while you sipped because, you know, you couldn't trust it. But so,
would the wall there be any more effective than a wall down on the Mexican border? The
wall is going to do, it would be far less effective because it's going to take them years to finish a wall like that. And there are going to be people sniping at them every single day as they're trying to put up a wall like that. It won't work. It absolutely won't work. The only kind of benefit it will provide is maybe to block gunfire. But it's not going to stop people from coming through.
Who is building the wall?
Quite honestly, the first I had heard about it was when I picked up the newspaper today. I'd never heard of that idea before. And all I could think of was somebody came from Britain and said, we use this example, we use this idea in Northern Ireland. And they didn't actually, well, in parts of Belfast they put up a wall, but they put up this fence to stop people from throwing all kinds of stuff, you know, rocks, garbage, occasionally grenades and stuff like that. And it calmed things down eventually. It was one of many, many factors that helped calm things down. But if that is the genesis of all of this, it's a totally different situation in Iraq from Northern Ireland. So I don't have much faith that it's going to work.
So I couldn't tell from the article who was building the wall.
Yeah.
Wall.
Somebody back there had a question. Let's see. Yeah. No, it really is happening everywhere, even in the New York Times. It's happening much faster at the morning news because we're caught in this kind of middle ground. We're not quite one of the big guys, but we're not a small newspaper either. And there was a time fewer than 10 years ago when we had 6 bureaus and 11 correspondents in the world, and we were rated as one of the 5 top newspapers in the country, and the people who were rating us cited our international coverage as an example of why we're one of the best. And for one reason or another, we allowed that status to erode. And a large part, I think, had to do with declining circulation. But even the New York Times has seen circulation decline, which is why the publisher said what he said. They see the internet as the replacement for newspaper, print newspapers, and that's the way it's going to go. All they are trying to do right now is wean the public from wanting to hold something in their hand to read it and get people to go online and do it. Now, before I move on to the next question, the biggest impact this is going to have, absolutely the biggest impact this is going to have, is what constitutes a journalist, the definition of who is a journalist. Because right now, you're at a point where you have people who come out of journalism school. You have at least one course, if not your entire time in journalism school, having pounded into you on a daily basis what are journalists' code of ethics. You don't lie. You don't misrepresent yourself. You always submit your work to a series of editors. When I produce an article, there are times when I'll have 8 different editors look at my story, all of them asking skeptical questions, making absolutely sure that I've got my facts straight, that I have answered as many possible questions as I can, because this is the system that ensures that what actually winds up in the newspaper afterwards, headlines notwithstanding, what winds up in the newspaper afterwards is as close as we can get to the real facts of an event. That is going to disappear, because now you've got bloggers who are calling themselves journalists, and the U.S. military doesn't know what to do about it, because some of these people are embedding over in Iraq and Afghanistan, calling themselves journalists. So if you get somebody who's actually putting up the money to send you over, then they give you the credential. And these people are blogging from the front lines, writing whatever the hell they want to, and nobody is editing it before it goes out. And once it's out on the internet, the public doesn't know. Is this the truth? Is this somebody's opinion? What?
Is it analysis versus...
Yeah, well, but even in journalistic analysis, you have a multiplicity of editors looking at your stuff to make sure it at least reflects the reality of the situation. These guys have no editor. They are loading straight up to the internet and out to the world. And everything we know about journalism is going to change as a result of that. It's a disaster.
Well, how does the public, that was the question, how does the public be able to look at what's on the internet? And when I went to the newspaper, when I read the Washington Post, New York Times, Dallas Morning News, I know that people went to J school. They had all the background to know that they had to get multiple sources to confirm stories and all that other good stuff. Now, you go to the internet and the Grudge Report or all this other type of stuff. How do you know any of that stuff is true? And for people who weren't raised with journalism backgrounds or having seen it before, somebody who's 20 years, 30 years junior, who's only seen the internet, how are they going to understand that the person, what they're reading on the internet, is true or not? Because they've never seen it the other way.
They don't. They because they don't know who Ben Bradley is. They don't know the whole process that led up to the establishment of journalism as the fourth estate. You know, the institution that served as one of the unofficial checks and balances on government and everything else that's going on in the world, to be the skeptics out there. I'm not saying we're always right, but at least people who have had a chance, experience, you know, older people understand what it's all about. But people probably age 30 and below have a completely different view of the world, which is why you can have these protesters in Seattle at the G8 summits and whatnot, who just go absolutely nutty when a member of the establishment press comes to do an interview with them. They practically will physically attack you because they don't trust you. And what they trust is what they read from their bloggers on their internet sites that they go to at the Starbucks, or, you know, I don't know who they trust these days, probably not Starbucks anymore, but it's an absolute level of mistrust and kind of skewed reality. I don't know where it's going to lead. It's extremely dangerous stuff.
Well, the public is not totally stupid. It may take us a while to catch up. What do you think about the possibility that a filtering organization will come along which says that these bloggers use certain journalistic standards, and so some educated people will only believe those sources and not a blogger out of nowhere?
It's obvious, even from your description of it, that it's gonna be a polarizing process eventually. Everybody is going to have their own kind of version of reality, version of the truth, and it's just going to be skewed, and it's going to be further skewed because newspapers are going to start increasingly posting articles before they've been edited. And I was covering the Pope's death in Italy, and we were 8 hours ahead of Dallas time, so. When they actually began the funeral procession that day, they asked me to file a story early for the web, and I wrote off this story, you know, describing everything that was happening, because it was going to be another almost 24 hours before people were going to pick up their newspapers and read it in the newspaper. So I filed this thing for the web. I mean, it didn't take 10 minutes before it was on the web. They did a very quick read of it. If one editor looked at it, I'd be surprised.
Do you not believe that the time will come in the near future when the educated public will only believe certain people that they have that had experience with and not bloggers in general?
The bloggers are going to become the people they believe in. That's what I think. And I think that's already happening. It's already that situation. It's not either or. The bloggers are going to be viewed as the same as the Tom Friedmans and the David Grovers, just the philosophers of our time and their means of communicating to the world through the internet. Let's see, somebody here had a question. Yes, sorry.
Mine was similar. Is there going to be, I think you've already said you're pessimistic about it, is there going to be a new role for journalists to be the librarians of this information that's thrown out there on the web? The new medium is definitely through the internet, podcasts,
sure,
and so on. The
yeah.
paper's gone.
Yeah.
But will a new world evolve where there is a standard of analysis, as the previous question was asking?
Well,
that journalism could evolve into.
Yeah. It the journalism schools now, and I have to admit, I hadn't been back to a journalism school in 20 years, and Texas Tech invited me to speak there, and they took me on a tour of the Texas Tech Journalism Department, which is just light years ahead of what it was when I was there. I mean, we were typing on IBM Selectric typewriters when I was there, and when I got out of Texas Tech, I graduated into the modern world of filing by telex machine. And so... So what they're teaching in journalism school now is don't simply be reliant on a computer to file your story to an editor that will be published in the newspaper the next day. The journalist of tomorrow is going to be literally Max Headroom. I don't know if any of you remember that show from the 1980s, but he was the complete journalist. He had the camera. He reported the news. He did everything all by himself. And that's literally what they're going to do. When a journalism student, Jim knows this better than I do because his daughter is in the middle of it right now, they have to learn how to do video. They have to learn how to put together an entire package, upload it to the internet, and then produce the print copy.
That's the technology. What about
the editing process, the analysis, all of that? Well, you know, journalism schools are still teaching the basics, and they're just saying if you have any interest in gaining the trust of your public, these are the standards you're going to have to apply to yourself every single day, and never, never let yourself stray from these ethics. Now, I don't know how many of you got a chance to check your front page of the morning news today. There's a huge story at the bottom, spread across the bottom of the page. Read it from start to finish if you can, because it's a story of a woman who was president of the Dallas Press Club. Won lots of awards because she handled all the judging for them, and well, she won 10 awards over the past 4 years, and it was only literally last week when a bunch of us started to try to find these stories, these award-winning stories that she wrote, and it was unbelievable. I found two of her stories on the internet, one of her stories, investigative stories, she won 2006 Investigative Reporter of the Year. I'm biased because I was competing for that award, and I had legitimate investigative stories. She wrote a story, her lead was something along the lines of how Southwest Securities had a particular problem, And they found an innovative solution to this problem. She was writing this for the bond buyer.
What's her name again?
Elizabeth Albanese.
Albanese. Yes. Yeah, we know her.
And you know her? Oh, my God. Well,
we co-sponsored the program with her.
Oh, no. Well, anyway. So this is a story all about how Southwest Securities did a really great job of handling some problem that they had. And then she won the award for Best Business Feature all about how Southwest Securities had done such a great job with something else that they did. And then the awards for those two categories, the only two that you can come up with on the internet, were those stories. And guess where she's working today? Southwest Securities. My guess is she won't be working there on Monday after they see the story in the morning news. This woman has just a long history of fraud and just outright lying.
Is this a problem with that guy up in the New York Times? What's his name?
Jason Blair.
Jason Blair, and then whoever was it, the Washington
Post? Jan Hook, yeah, I was there for that.
What's going on? Is it more epidemic now than it was 20 years ago?
No. It's just very, occasionally they slip into journalism just like they do into, any other profession. I don't know what would draw them to journalism because, eventually we do root them out. Everybody is always looking for a pattern of if you just have two corrections successfully in the newspaper, people start to ask questions. And we turn on each other in a second. Which is why I had those ambushes, sniping. That's what it's all about. And it's getting worse because, our pool is shrinking very quickly.
We have time for one more question.
All right, well.
Any new questions?
Let's see. You hadn't asked one, so go ahead.
Do you find that there is any positiveness in the transformation of print media going to the internet with relation to journalistic views versus bloggers, in the sense that somehow, some way along the way, they will sort of converge, in the sense that with regard to the comment that was made earlier on the newer generation being relying on blogging as their views and their comfortness with the honesty of bloggers versus the source that journalists go through.
Yeah. The positive, I don't see anything positive in the public, in any member of the public choosing one blogger as their only source of information. That would be extremely rare that anybody would choose that. And certainly, yes, if you're a college student and you're growing up and you don't trust the establishment media and you choose to look at just this one blog site or just a few kind of counterculture blog sites as your main source of information, that's understandable. Eventually, you're going to grow up and you're going to understand that's not how the world works. Let's hope that things don't get horribly skewed along the way. I think, by and large, the general public is going to understand that there are news outlets out there that are trustworthy for the most part and reliable, and they will, particularly in times of crisis, turn to them. They're not going to turn to a blogger for their news. So positive, I don't know that I would say positive. I just don't see this entire process having a good end unless somehow there is a kind of a national, if not worldwide, dialogue that develops where people understand that we really do have standards that we employ on a daily, if not hourly, basis to ensure that the public gets as accurate portrayal of the events as possible.
How much do advertisers influence that opinion?
Rarely. No. You would think that it's a lot. I used to think it was zero. I won't say that now, but it's not as much as you would think. Now there are other financial interests that do influence what gets into the newspaper. So there are things you won't see in the Dallas Morning News that you really should see,
right.
And they're protected because of various factors. I'll give an example that would be similar to something I'm thinking of in the Morning News, which I'm not going to tell you about. But if you've ever seen the movie The Insider with Russell Crowe and Al Pacino, that'll give you a good idea of the forces at play. When it comes to the point where a news outlet's ability to survive is going to be endangered by a larger company's ability to swallow that news outlet through litigation, then the news outlet will just choose not to publish the information, even if it means bringing down big tobacco or a major defense contractor. It'll happen. So.
And Tom, before you wrap up, you had mentioned in your last presentation about what actually happened with your friend Jack, who shot at you.
Yeah.
What became of him?
I'm sorry, I didn't finish that story.
I mean, that's just important because, I mean, diplomacy-wise, that's not the best face of America to just be picking people up off the street and kidnapping them for
nobody. Yeah, he was, luckily, both the American government and the Afghan governments understood that this was really bad stuff this guy over in Afghanistan was doing by picking up people off the streets and having his own private interrogation center. And so they arrested him and put him on trial. It was not a model of kind of, you know, jurisprudence and how to conduct a fair trial, but it was a trial. He was convicted. He went to prison. And he is
here in Afghanistan.
No, in Afghanistan, and he's still there. And he threatened to—I don't know if he threatened to kill me. He has certainly threatened to do nasty things to me once he gets out, among other journalists. I actually got into his prison cell one day when he was not there, and I left a note for him saying I was there because I wanted him to know, you know, I know you're here. But I wrote a story about his prison conditions. It was unbelievable prison conditions. He had internet. He had satellite TV. He had a suite, basically. It was a huge living room with a kitchen, a separate bathroom, and a separate bedroom, along with his two friends. And I wanted him to know, I know how you're living in this prison. And I really had to talk my way into the prison. But he's still there, and the rumor is that he could be let out literally in a day. So I'm kind of ready for that whenever it happens. Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.